fact sheet gives several ways, quote, to identify native fascists and devotes the conclusion to ways to stop fascism in the United States, quote, by making democracy work, unquote. Before inserting the in fact issue in the congressional record, Representative Sabbath addressed the House in concluding with these remarks. Mr. Speaker, I only regret that the rules and regulations of the War Department preclude the naming of outstanding American fascists such as the DuPonts, the Pews, the Girdlers, the Weirs, General Van Horn Mosley, H.W. Prentice, President of the National Association of Manufacturers, Merwin K. Hart, Head of the National Economic Society, and others, including the 30 fascists charged with conspiracy and seditious activities and tried, but due to the untimely death of the trial judge, still at large. Congressman Sabbath's speech created a sort of sensation in the liberal press. The Christian Science Monitor, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and the usual handful of excellent newspapers published parts of fact sheet number 64 and the Sabbath remarks naming a group he considered native fascists. The official organ of the CIO, the News, republished the orientation document, as did the organ of the Railroad Brotherhood's Labor, so that the government statement reached millions outside the Army. Rankin of Mississippi and Claire Hoffman of Michigan then demanded that the Army drop its entire orientation program or tone down its definition of fascism. And the Army surrendered. I did not know this until Henry Hoke published his book, It's a Secret, in which he discloses that H. Ralph Burton, counsel for the House Military Affairs Committee, gave in to the requests of Rankin and Hoffman. Hoke describes Burton as, quote, a thorough reactionary, unquote. Burton was not only a former attorney for William Lüdecke, who had openly proclaimed himself, quote, the number two Nazi in America, unquote, but he was also general counsel for Coughlin's National Union for Social Justice. By the way, that, of course, is Father Coughlin, the radio priest, in some ways the precursor to people like Pat Robertson and also people like Rush Limbaugh. By the way, bear in mind we'll talk about that next week. Bear in mind, Messrs. Limbaugh, etc. We're going to talk a little bit about Father Coughlin in weeks to come. Well, actually, I'll see if we have time to get to it. But Father Coughlin was at one time a paid Nazi agent. This revealed in fact. Back to attempts by reactionary members of Congress and also the House Un-American Activities Committee to suppress fact sheet number 4 about fascism. Fact sheet number 64, excuse me, about fascism. Returning to Even the Gods Can't Change History. Rankin and Chief HUAC Counsel Adamson used the Hearst Press to create public opinion in favor of destroying the orientation program. The Hearst Washington correspondent, who had previously been sending in fact, suppressed news, now sent a long report, which I did not publish at the time because he had warned me it might get him into trouble. It began, Washington. Ernie Adamson, counsel for the House Un-American Activities Committee, declared today that an inquiry had disclosed that the U.S. orientation series of Army talks was designed to foster communism. He singled out especially Army Talk No. 64, an expose of fascism, which he termed, quote, probably the high watermark of attempts to communize the armed personnel, unquote. Bear in mind fact sheet, the point number 5 in that fact sheet. Soldiers are advised that it is proper to call members of the Communist Party communists, or Reds for short, but pinning these label on people whose politics one opposes, quote, is a favorite trick of native as well as foreign fascists, unquote. That trick, of course, being used here by Ernie Adamson. Continuing. Adamson said the investigation by his staff of investigators had not yet been completed, but had gone far enough to disclose that the Army talks represented, quote, an attempt to indoctrinate men in the ranks with communistic ideas and philosophy. Adamson said the committee had been informed by Army authorities that the Army talks were no longer being distributed. Quote, some of the gentlemen who participated in drawing them up are out, and we've been assured the skids have been put under them, unquote, he said. Adamson complained, however, that private organizations were now publishing them. Adamson identified Army fact sheet number 64 as, quote, telling the boys how to identify fascists, unquote. The United States, and then Sully's goes on to comment, the United States Army's effort to educate its people about fascism was apparently subversive in the opinion of Congressman Rankin and Attorney Adamson. In the HUAC 1946 report, 79th Congress, House of Representatives, Union Calendar number 66, the Rankin Committee said that General Marshall's authorized document was, quote, one of the dirtiest blots on the history of the War Department, unquote, and characterized it as, again quoting, red poison, unquote, using the phrases previously appearing in the Hearst Press, which had originated this attack on the Army. The destruction of the Army orientation program was not the only reactionary victory in wartime reported during the in-fact decade. Another notable case involved the Office of War Information, or OWI, which President Roosevelt had set up under one of the best-known and most liberal journalists of the time, Elmer Davis. Its purpose was to inform the American public as well as the men in uniform. FDR realized at the time of Pearl Harbor that that infamous action would unite the citizenry, at least for the moment, to support a war against international fascism. However, he also knew that there were still pro-Nazis and pro-fascists in number, and perhaps worst of all, millions who did not know what the real enemy was and did not care. The vast strata of the indifferent and the apathetic. On May 3, 1945, after 16 months of war, in fact charged that despite great publishing activity, the OWI had not issued one little unkind word about the enemy, Nazi fascism. This statement was supported by letters exchanged with the OWI itself. A reader, the Reverend Don L. West of Georgia, had asked for a pamphlet or other material on the nature of the enemy, anything at all except the story of the treacherous attack on Pearl Harbor. In seconding the request, in fact requested a duplicate set for itself. A large package soon arrived, but it contained not one sheet of paper even critical of the fascist forms of government in the nations we were fighting. In fact, then offered OWI the rights to republish whatever chapters it wanted of Sawdust Caesar and exposés of fascism and Nazism in its previous 133 issues. In reply, OWI sent a 2.5-line note saying, quote, we have a number of projects underway on this subject, and so we shall not have to call on you, unquote. At exactly this time, a schism occurred at OWI. 15 writers, including Henry F. Pringle and Milton Mackay, or McKay, M-A-C-K-A-Y, resigned after issuing a public statement saying, quote, we are leaving because of our conviction that it is impossible for us, under those who now control our output, to tell the truth, end quote. Truth about what? The only subjects untouched were Nazism and fascism. The three most powerful newspaper chains, Hearst, Scripps Howard, and McCormick Patterson, took this occasion to join in a violent attack on the ONI, demanding its abolition. Little as it had done to enlighten the public and the army, the press of the right was already its enemy. Of course, there were the usual exceptions. The liberal New York Post, for example, knowing what the real trouble at OWI was, headlined its report, OWI to soft pedal war on fascism. And the very liberal PM used the headline, Guild Book Deemphasizes Fascism. The latter story from Gordon Cole referred to a new book of instructions for writers. Said Cole, quote, it will teach the writers that the enemy is many bad things, but it will de-emphasize the fact that the enemy is basically fascist. In the 7 sets of instructions or information sheets describing the enemy, the word fascist is mentioned just once. As a result, some officials outside OWI are asking whether this war is now to be sold to the American people as something other than a war against fascism. One of the OWI information sheets is devoted to atrocities and fails to mention that the Nazis committed the most horrible atrocities in modern history. There is not even a mention that the first action of a fascist, also a communist dictatorship, is to abolish the free press and free labor unions. In self-defense, the OWI declared that the 15 writers had resigned because they wanted to publish more pamphlets, thus wasting paper. Max Lerner of the New York Post replied that, quote, the entire 12-month program of OWI pamphlets did not use up as much paper as a single issue of Life, unquote. The OWI then kept its silence. From Washington, our correspondent gave the reason for the failure of all educational objectives during the war. Fear of the Un-American Committee and their strongest supporters in the House of Representatives, mostly Southerners, several with records of membership in the Ku Klux Klan, the Silvershirts, and other organizations. These congressmen attacked even Elmer Davis, accusing him of being a member of the American Labor Party, which in their view was un-American or subversive. Quote, the most important fact to remember, wrote our Washington correspondent, again quoting, is that while the United States is fighting the Nazi fascist nations, The D's committee and the reactionaries in Congress, and also a major part of the American press, are still fighting the New Deal. And for many of them, the New Deal is still a greater danger, unquote. The younger reader may find it hard to believe that during the reign of the un-American committees, throughout the war and into the McCarthy era, there was so powerful a pro-fascist element in the House of Representatives. On March 17, 1947, InFact reported that after the United States government had published a book entitled Communism in Action and distributed 100,000 copies free, the Library of Congress Legislative Reference Service, compiler of that work, prepared a 325-page manuscript called Fascism in Action. Two Republican spokesmen, Carl LeConte of Iowa and Robert Corbett of Pennsylvania, kept a House resolution authorizing its publication bottled up in committee. Representative Wright Patman wrote to InFact that he would force publication, quote, even if it means reading it into the congressional record page by page, unquote. The book was the usual, well-researched, impartial job the Library of Congress does for everyone in government, regardless of party. In a brief foreword, Patman states that, quote, there are many symptoms of fascism in our own democratic society, unquote, the only line expressing an editorial viewpoint. On several occasions, for 4 months, Patman insisted that the House authorize publication. On each occasion, Republicans objected. One of them, Ivor Fenton, is on the record saying, quote, what's fascism and what's wrong with it, unquote. Throughout 1947, InFact urged readers to write their congressmen. At one time, the House voted to print a 1,500 copies for use of members, compared to the first printing of 100,000 copies of Communism in Action. Representative Fred Busby of Illinois made a speech in the House attacking InFact and its editor because he said he had investigated 1,000 requests for the proposed book and found that almost all of them came from InFact readers. John Rankin and a Mississippi colleague, John Williams, followed with speeches opposing the publication of any copies. In August, readers reported that when they requested the book on fascism, their representatives, all of them Republicans, sent them instead copies of Communism in Action, in many cases accompanying that book with a note recommending it. In September, a small printing of Fascism in Action was made, but the House refused to permit free distribution. Those who requested it were told to send 40 cents to the superintendent of documents for a pamphlet of 206 pages. At this time, every member of Congress had on hand stacks of copies of Communism in Action, but no copies of the new pamphlet. The number of copies the House allowed for sale to the American public was exactly 600. Patman, seconded by Congresswoman Helen Gehagan Douglas and several others, continued to fight for more printings and for free copies. 2 years after the effort began, Patman was able to announce that the superintendent of documents had sold 36,790 copies of Fascism in Action at 40 cents. He added, quote, the tyranny of the right can be as dangerous as the tyranny of the left, unquote, and again introduced a resolution to allow free distribution of 100,000 of the fascism booklet. By this time, congressmen had already sent out free 600,000 copies of the booklet on communism. Quote, fascism is today an ever-present danger to our democracy, unquote, concluded Patman. No newspaper reported either his fight for the pamphlet or his speeches. It was either suppression or indifference. That was how I concluded my program, or the last segment of my program, on a Sunday, July 2nd of 1995. I awoke the next day to see George Seldes' obituary. George Seldes, as it turns out, had passed away on July 2nd of 1995, and I'm going to read a section of the obituary that appeared in the New York Times on Monday, July 3rd of 1995. The obituary is written by William Dick, or Dickie, D-I-C-K-E. It's headlined, George Seldes is Dead at 104, an early, fervent press critic. It reads in part as follows, skipping down of the newsletter In Fact, upon or from which that last segment that I read to you was drawn. In Fact, which claimed 176,000... which claimed 176,000 subscribers at its peak in 1947, had a self-described progressive view and was established to present, quote, the real inside news, the kind newspapers frequently get but dare not print, unquote, Mr. Seldes wrote when he helped found it. Again quoting, George Seldes was an important force for good in American journalism, said Ben H. Bagdikian, the press critic, in an interview, again quoting, "In the years just before and after World War II, when standard publishing practice was far more wedded than it is today to archaic conventions of slighting non-establishment news, Seldes was a lonely and critical source of important information and insights," unquote. In fact, which has been described as the nation's first successful journalism review, also carried strong attacks on business and issued warnings against what Mr. Seldes regarded as reactionary forces. A favorite target was the National Association of Manufacturers. Skipping down, "For 3 years, Mr. Seldes covered the Spanish Civil War as a freelancer, concluding," he said later, "that news coverage of the conflict was marred by unthinking acceptance of lies from the pro-Franco side." After returning to the United States, he wrote the two books on the American press which his reputation as a newspaper critic largely rests. In Lords of the Press, published in 1935, he offered mostly scathing portraits of the nation's major newspapers. In Freedom of the Press in 1938, he discussed the influence of business interests on the press and declared that more censorship was caused by advertising pressures than by government. He called for an ethics code for reporters and lived long enough to see journalism schools offer ethics courses and press organizations give attention to ethical issues. Quote, "Even for later journalists who did not accept all of Seldes' analysis, he had an effect on forcing a great number of people to consider what the role of journalism really is," unquote, Mr. Bagdikian said. After Seldes' newsletter ceased publication in 1950, when his warnings about fascism seemed out of tune with rising public concern about communism, he found new outlets for his writing. And again, the segments of Even the Gods Can't Change History were drawn from information originally published in Fact. George Seldes dead at 104 on Monday, July 2nd, the date that was recorded. Well done, George. Rest in peace. That a tribute to George Seldes recorded on July 2nd and July 3rd of 1995. We're going to take a short musical break, and then we're going to continue with some more material from George Seldes, Even the Gods Can't Change History. And we're going to, actually, this might be from Never Tire of Protesting. I think it's also from Even the Gods Can't Change History. We're going to take a short musical break, and then we're going to continue with tonight's special. I think we could say tonight's really day, but what the heck, it's PM. You're listening to the KFJC Memorial Day Weekend Month of Mayhem special, Uncle Sam and the Swastika. We're going to be going all the way up till 10 o'clock tonight. Short musical break, and then more of tonight's program. Broadcasting from Foothill College, this is KFJC Los Altos Hills. What we're going to do now is to go back to tonight's Uncle Sam, or today's Month of Mayhem Memorial Day Weekend special, Uncle Sam and the Swastika. This next side is entitled Roots of the Cold War, once again drawing on information from George Seldes. Those of you who are taping, this side is a half hour in length. 3, 2, 1, here we go. Hello, my name is Dave Emery. And in this segment, we are once again going to step back into the past, in this case, 50 years into the past, and we are going to be examining some columns by the very famous columnist Drew Pearson that were written by Drew Pearson near the end of World War II, specifically on April 25th and April 26th of 1945. I'm speaking now on the evening or the afternoon of September 2nd of 1995, and some of the very last of the many 50th anniversary commemorations has been taking place. The 50-year commemorations began really in 19... Well, I shouldn't say they began, but they gained momentum in June of 1944 with the 50th anniversary of the Normandy invasion, D-Day. And they gained steam as the 50th anniversary of the end of the war in Europe, as well as the liberation of many of the concentration camps, took place. The 50th anniversary of the first dropping in wartime of the atomic bomb, namely the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and later Nagasaki, took place. The actual first use of an atomic bomb against human beings, however, took place in a test in July of 1944 in Suisun Bay in the San Francisco Bay Area, when in the Port Chicago explosion, the explosion of the E.A. Bryan, ostensibly an ammunition ship explosion, was used to mask the first test, this of the Mark II weapon, never actually deployed in combat. The 50th anniversary is peaked with, or I should say that perhaps not peaked, but reached to what will hopefully be a conclusion with the 50th anniversary of the signing of the surrender on the deck of the battleship USS Missouri. That surrender by the Japanese officially ending the combat of World War II. As we have seen in numerous archive shows available from archives on audio, about which I'll have more to say later, we have seen that many of the combatants from World War II and many of the units continue to struggle not only in the Cold War, and we're going to examine the roots of the Cold War and how those roots are inextricably connected with very powerful industrial and financial forces themselves, inextricably linked with the powers of fascism, and in turn, inextricably linked with the American power structure. But many of the forces that were fighting in World War II on the fascist side later regrouped and began, quote, fighting alongside the Allies, unquote. They actually regrouped with the West during the Cold War. And in some cases, they actually perpetuated the combat, such as the various nationalist and fascist guerrilla groups in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union, which had actually fought under the direction of the OKW, the Oberkommando der Wehrmacht, German military high command, and later jumped to U.S. intelligence, NATO, and other umbrellas, while essentially simply switching uniforms and perpetuating the combat. As we look back not only on the 50th anniversary of the Japanese surrender, but also related events, and in the Drew Pearson columns that I'm going to be reading, Drew Pearson was observing the formation of the world to come as the conference which was to result in the formation of the United Nations, or to kick off the United Nations, was gathering steam here in San Francisco. I would also note that the columns that I'm going to be reading were suppressed by Drew Pearson's distributor, the Bell Syndicate. They were later introduced into the read into the congressional record by Congressperson Helen Gehagan Douglas, one of the first of many worthwhile people to fall beneath the political battle axe of Richard Nixon, about whom we'll have more to say in just a minute. But again, as the 50th anniversary of the formal surrender of the Japanese in World War II is passing behind us, as we here in the Bay Area have concluded this past spring, the 50th anniversary of the formation of the United Nations, which took place right here in San Francisco, I think it is worth contemplating the historical and political forces which produced fascism and which produced World War II, because those forces are absolutely central to the contemporary operations of the world, the same types of financial and industrial powers with their corresponding political and national security elements have had much to do with shaping the world today, and had much to do with shaping the course of what came to be known as the Cold War, a struggle which eventually saw the dissolution of the Soviet Union and the financial and, in my opinion, political bankrupting of the United States, a country which is, in my opinion, in the last stages of descent into fascism, and which will not only collapse financially, but I suspect sometime in the 21st century will break apart geographically as well. This will seem like utter drivel to the uninitiated. However, stay tuned to keep your eyes peeled, those of you who live into the 21st century, for the secession of Hawaii, perhaps even the secession of the American Pacific Northwest, perhaps even a real or de facto secession of the American South. I suspect this will follow a total economic collapse and a political crisis in which America will lurch completely into overt German-style fascism. I expect a balkanization of the United States at some point around the middle or second half of the 21st century, if not before. However, we are getting ahead of ourselves, and I think in order to once again commemorate the formal end of World War II, and in order to contemplate the forces which brought about that conflict, which later precipitated the Cold War, and in fact were in the process of helping to precipitate the Cold War, as we shall see, even as World War II was winding down, and in order to understand the nature of the political forces not only underlying World War II and the Cold War, but the political forces underlying fascism in the World War II and pre-World War II periods, and the forces underlying fascism today, because in order to understand some of the statements that I'm making, and I'm sure they will quite understandably sound preposterous to new or uninitiated listeners, when I talk about fascism coming to this country, it's because fascism is not something alien to the United States. Many of our most powerful industrialists, financiers, political and national security figures were ardently wholeheartedly pro-Nazi and pro-fascist. Their dollars and their efforts helped to not only financially underwrite but politically support and in some cases almost create the fascist powers of Europe during World War II. Those same forces saw to it that denazification and the elimination of fascism were essentially a formal political myth. It never really occurred, not at the institutional level. And those same forces found it only too easy to ally with the residual forces of fascism in order to begin waging the Cold War against the Soviet Union. Earlier in the summer of 1995, one of the foremost political researchers and journalists in this country's history, George Seldes, passed away at the ripe old age of 104. Seldes is viewed by many as the dean of American investigative reporting. I am among those who see him in that light, and I could not exaggerate the importance and the brilliance of George Seldes' work. George Seldes was a brilliant investigative reporter and anti-fascist. His work, sadly, has been eclipsed following the McCarthy period. However, the importance of his work, as I said, could not be exaggerated. A listener was going through one of George Seldes' many, many books, and Seldes was nothing if not prolific. This particular book is called The People Don't Know, subtitled The American Press and the Cold War, authored, of course, by George Seldes, last name S-E-L-D-E-S, published by Geyer Associates in New York, that's G-A-E-R, and copyright 1949. In this particular book, again subtitled The American Press and the Cold War, in Appendix 4, there is a very important couple of columns that were written by the very famous syndicated columnist Drew Pearson. These, however, were suppressed at the suggestion of his editors and, quote, at the insistence of J.P. Morgan and Company and the Chase Bank, as we shall see. Later, they were introduced into the Congressional Record on May 1st, 1945, by Helen Gehagen Douglas, later defeated for re-election by Richard Nixon, an individual whose entire political career was inextricably linked with the forces of fascism and organized crime. More about Richard Nixon, our, quote, elder statesman, unquote, later on in the program. In The People Don't Know, again, The American Press and the Cold War by George Seldes, again in Appendix 4, there is this title over the columns by Drew Pearson. Again, these were written in San Francisco on April 25th and April 26th of 1945, a little over 50 years ago. Again, I'm speaking on 9-2-95 for the benefit of those who hear this program on tape. This particular appendix was entitled by George Seldes, U.S., Nazis, and World War III by Drew Pearson. The note underneath that reads, several important columns written by Drew Pearson were suppressed by suggestion of his editors, the Bell Syndicate, and, quote, at the insistence of J.P. Morgan and Company and the Chase Bank, unquote, according to Congresswoman Helen Gehagen Douglas, who inserted the whole series in the Congressional Record May 1, 1945, from which the most important parts are given below. And the first column, again from San Francisco, April 25th, reads as follows, as reprinted by George Seldes, and is introduced into the Congressional Record on 5-1-45 by Helen Gehagen Douglas. It is no exaggeration to say that the seeds of the next war will be nourished or rooted up at San Francisco. Of course, this is upon the anniversary of the conference at which the United Nations was formed in late April and early May of 1945 in San Francisco. Again, a little over 50 years ago. Beginning again, it is no exaggeration to say that the seeds of the next war will be nourished or rooted up at San Francisco. Actually, the seeds have already been planted, but the roots are not deep, and they can be torn up. Interjecting, of course, they were not torn up. They grew to fruition. Continuing. Already certain groups, quote, already certain groups inside the State Department and the British Foreign Office have been jockeying to build up Germany after the war as a bulwark against Russia. Already United States admirals have focused the attention of the entire world on the island bases we are taking from Japan so that Russia is becoming suspicious they will be aimed against her. Already there is evidence that the brass hats in at least two countries, plus certain diplomats, are getting nervous trigger fingers. Finally, Admiral Ernest King, commander of the fleet, took things into his own hands and made a public statement against the president's, FDR's, policy regarding Pacific Islands. In other words, he went over the head of his commander-in-chief. The Russians, whose intelligence is the best in the world, already knew that Admiral King is the man who wanted to build up a big navy now as protection against Russia later. They also knew that Admiral King has opposed Russia coming into the war against Japan, and wants the U.S. to do the job alone. Eisenhower and Marshall do not side with King. In numerous archive shows, including the first two Radio Free America shows, Radio Free America program number 10, the seminal archive show Uncle Sam and the Swastika, among other broadcasts, we have dealt with the pro-fascist and pro-Nazi sentiment of many of the most powerful industrialists, financiers, and political and national security figures in this country, and their desire to not only use Germany in the pre-World War II period as a bulwark against, quote, communism, unquote, but their recapitulation of that same stratagem and their eventual successful realization of that same stratagem during the Cold War. Again, although certainly there are many, many fine people in Germany of sincerely democratic and anti-Nazi sentiment, the institutions in Germany were never effectively denazified. The industrialist financiers, political figures, military and intelligence figures, civil service, judges, prosecutors, and laws from Nazi Germany were basically simply put right back into effect. I've dealt with that in Radio Free America number 2, Radio Free America number 37, and in a very important 13-part miscellaneous archive series entitled Reunited Germany, the New Danger, which many listeners have already heard. The seeds of what Drew Pearson referred to as the next war, obviously that next war was the Cold War, were indeed being laid in San Francisco, or were being planted in San Francisco, and we're going to take up next the column that Drew Pearson wrote the very next day from the column that we just heard, that namely April, the column that we're about to read is from April 26th of 1945. Remember that these columns were suppressed by his editors at the suggestion of the Morgan and Chase Banks, who, as we have seen in the past and will see in the future, were ardently and wholeheartedly pro-fascist and did business with the fascist powers of Europe, even after America's entry into the war. The next column reads, San Francisco, April 26th. For a long time, it has been no secret that a group inside the State Department favored a soft peace for Germany with a view to making her a bulwark against Russia after the war. But as long as Roosevelt was in the White House, the State Department appeasers kept quiet. However, on the day after his body was buried, a meeting of the German Reparations Committee was held in the office of Assistant Secretary Will Clayton, C-L-A-Y-T-O-N, at which both the State and War Department suddenly reversed Roosevelt's policy of a hard peace. Specifically, they argued against the removal of Nazi factories, machine tools, plant equipment, or goods out of Germany. The Russians had proposed the removal of German war plants to build up the hundreds of Russian factories destroyed by Germany. Clayton argued that American policy should favor leaving factory equipment and machinery in Germany so she can get back on a sound economic basis. He even mentioned the fact that Germany would need to import cotton to manufacture clothes. Clayton is the biggest cotton exporter in the world and did a heavy business with the Nazis before the war. Unfortunately, the Russians are all too familiar with the attitude of the State and War Departments toward them. The Russians cannot forget, among other things, the strategy of the Clevedon set in England, that's C-L-I-V-E-D-E-N. I'm not sure how that's pronounced, by the way. I pronounce it Clevedon, maybe it's Clevedon, I don't know. I've never heard it spoken aloud. Anyway, the Clevedon set in England, with which Churchill was once sympathetic, to stir up war between Germany and Russia while England sat on the sidelines. The Russians also know all too well the type of anti-Russian conversation that goes on at the home of Mrs. Evelyn Walsh Hope Diamond McLean, when she entertains the elite of Washington society at her famous dinners at what is sometimes called the headquarters of the American Clevedon set. The Russians knew in advance, for instance, that the Douglas Aircraft Company had sold the plans for its DC-4 to Japan for $1 million before Pearl Harbor. And they have been especially interested in the War Department survey of the damage done to German war plants by U.S. planes, a survey to be undertaken by a group of bankers and top insurance executives, including Henry C. Alexander, vice president of J.P. Morgan, Fred Searles, Jr., president of several J.P. Morgan mine companies, Franklin Dollier, D-O-L-I-E-R, president of the Prudential Life Insurance Company, one of the corporation heads who founded and subsidized the American Legion in 1919, and Robert P. Russell, president of Standard Oil Development Company. Interrupting, we have taken a look at the profound role of American industrialists and financiers in not only supporting the Third Reich industrially and financially, but politically as well, and the profound role of those same industrial and financial interests in seeing to it that their counterparts and business partners in Germany and Italy with whom they had done business were not, in fact, rooted out, denazified, or tried. Also note, by the way, that these columns were suppressed at the instigation of the Chase and Morgan banks who did business with the fascist powers of Europe. They were introduced into the congressional record by Helen Gehagen Douglas, who was defeated by Richard Nixon, an individual whose entire political career is inseparable from the forces of international fascism. Another of his early political conquests was Jerry Voorhees, who, as we saw in Radio Free America number 2, led the fight on the floor of Congress to break up the IG Farben Nazi chemical cartel. I would also note that in a segment that listeners will be hearing later this evening or in subsequent weeks, the role of Richard Nixon in an Allen Dulles and U.S. intelligence project to settle Nazi war criminals and a Third Reich and Eastern European fascist collaborators in the United States in areas that had large numbers of Jewish voters to counteract the perceived effect of those Jewish voters. This project was an Allen Dulles project. It was headed up by Richard Nixon. One of the spokespersons for one of the related projects was Ronald Reagan. This was done in conjunction with the Crusade for Freedom and the Office of Policy Coordination. We dealt with that in Radio Free America number 37. Ronald Reagan was the spokesperson for this project. William Casey actually handled many of the machinations by which the State Department ushered these people into the United States. This, however, was Richard Nixon's baby. And as we saw in Radio Free America number 2, Richard Nixon was instrumental in bringing Nicolae Malaxa, a business partner of Hermann Göring and the financier of the Romanian fascist Iron Guard, into the United States. His Whittier Law Office was used as a front company, which served as the justification for keeping Malaxa in the United States and was successfully resisting deportation efforts. Later, Nixon invited Valerian Trifa, Viorel Trifa, the leader of the Green Shirts, and another Romanian Iron Guardist who led a brutal pogrom in Bucharest in which hundreds of Jews were killed. A number of them were slaughtered in the municipal slaughterhouse and then hung on meat hooks with the sign Kosher Meat. He later became the Archbishop of the American Romanian Orthodox Episcopate and was invited by Richard Nixon to give the opening prayer before the United States Senate in 1955. It is interesting that Richard Nixon has acquired the totally inappropriate political legend as an elder statesman and a Democrat. It was almost nothing he did that was Democratic, from his role with the Odessa and bringing Nazi war criminals into the United States to his role in the assassination of President Kennedy, his probable role in the assassination of Robert Kennedy and the shooting of George Wallace, his attempts to stage a provocation of the 1972 Republican Convention to force the cancellation of the 72 elections and the instigation of martial law, his massive, virtually lifelong complicity with organized crime and the drug trade, his seminal role in setting up the many of the heroin refiners or in the Southeast Asian drug traffic, and also his role with the Miami and Latin American fascist milieu grouped around the Bay of Pigs situation. Merely some of the many highlights or lowlights of Richard Nixon's, quote, role as a Democrat, unquote, with a small d. Totally false political mythology, but one that a lot of people subscribe to. We should note that Richard Nixon's political genesis took place at this time and in conjunction with the forces that we're looking at here. Continuing with the Drew Pearson column from 4/26/45. Considering the manner in which Standard Oil of New Jersey collaborated with Hitler's cartels even after the war broke in Europe, and considering how the J.P. Morgan branch bank in Paris collaborated with the Nazis even after Pearl Harbor, you can't blame the Russians for wondering whether this survey actually isn't for the purpose of getting a line on German industry and building it up after the war. As we saw in Uncle Sam and the Swastika and Radio Free America programs 1 and 2, that is exactly what happened. And indeed, these same industrialists and financiers, many of them doubling as intelligence operatives, were instrumental in seeing to it that that's the way things worked. By the way, a current book, The Secret War Against the Jews, subtitled How Western Espionage Betrayed the Jewish People, co-authored by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens, hardcover St. Martin's, 1994, is an excellent source for getting a handle on much of this information. Beginning that last paragraph again. Considering the manner in which Standard Oil of New Jersey collaborated with Hitler's cartels even after the war broke in Europe, and considering how the J.P. Morgan branch bank in Paris collaborated with the Nazis even after Pearl Harbor, you can't blame the Russians for wondering whether this survey actually isn't for the purpose of getting a line on German industry and building it up after the war. Already, the State Department is being bombarded by American industrialists who owned factories in Germany before the war and want to go back and start operating them. Among the leading pressure boys is Graham Howard, vice president of General Motors, in charge of operations in Europe and Germany. By the way, we talked about him in Uncle Sam and the Swastika. Note also that many American corporations, as we saw in Uncle Sam and the Swastika, were compensated for plants that were bombed by the Allies in World War II. Continuing. Howard helped organize Franco's of Graham Howard, whom we looked at in Uncle Sam and the Swastika. Howard helped organize Franco's truck transport service during the Spanish Civil War, has a personal interest in the Opel Auto Works in Germany, and has been busy as a hound dog around the State Department wanting to get back to Germany. Quote, naturally, they can't have a hard peace if they are to build up Germany, so they don't want German factories and machine tools carted off to Russia. Another factor making the Russians suspicious is the British demand that food which the Russian army finds in Germany be used to feed the German people rather than to feed the starving Poles and Russian slave laborers. Shortly before he left London, both Foreign Minister Eden and Sir James Grigg, British War Minister, took the position in secret talks with the United States officials that food found in Germany must be used to feed the German, not Polish and Russian civilians. The British argument is that if German food is diverted to the Poles and Russians, the Allies will have to import more to feed the Germans. Finally, the Russians are probably most suspicious of the mysterious U.S. espionage organization called OSS. The OSS, or Office of Strategic Services, has, strangely, distributed some of the most powerful bankers' representatives in the United States of America at key points where they can influence U.S. policy in occupied Germany. The roster of OSS men who have been operating, who have been or are operating in Europe, reads like a blue stocking list of the first 60 families. It includes Paul Mellon, son of Andrew Mellon, Junius and Henry Morgan of the House of Morgan, Alfred DuPont, Lester Armour of the Chicago Armours, Gordon Auchincloss and John Auchincloss, by the way, blood relatives of Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, continuing Warwick Potter, Harold Coolidge, William Van Allen of the Astor family, and Alan Dulles, attorney for various international bankers with previous connections in Germany. Note, the Dulles Law Firm, of which John Foster Dulles, one of the main consultants of the reactionary or Vandenberg wing of the U.S. delegation at San Francisco, is the head, is the attorney of its American Schroeder Bank affiliated with the British Schroeders, which had business connections with the Nazi Schroeders. All are relatives. By the way, we dealt with the Dulles Schroeder Third Reich connection in Uncle Sam and the Swastika, a very, very good book talking about the relationship between the OSS and the Wall Street elite, The Old Boys, The American Elite and the Origins of the CIA by Burton Hirsch, H-E-R-S-H. That book is out of print, but it's well worthwhile. Continuing with this Drew Pearson column from 4/26/45, again suppressed at the time. Some of these may not deserve the suspicion focused upon them, but others more than make up for it. And anyone listening for 30 minutes to their conversation about the next war and building up Germany as a partner in that war can understand why the Russians wrongly accuse us of a deal to permit the American army to enter Berlin first. This is the kind of underlying suspicion which must be killed immediately and permanently if the machinery of San Francisco is to bring about permanent peace. As we shall see, these suspicions were to a large extent well-founded, or as we have seen, I should say. Continuing. San Francisco, April 27th. This is the next Drew Pearson column. When the American army swept into Germany, it was fortunate enough to capture an interesting figure in Dr. H.J. Caesar, C-A-E-S-A-R, the counterpart of our alien property custodian, who had charge of all American banks and alien property seized in France. Dr. Caesar was cross-examined at length. From him came highly enlightening and hitherto secret information about the manner in which certain British and American branch banks in Paris collaborated with the Germans after the fall of France. His testimony highlights the main issue underlying the problem of future peace, namely, whether, despite all the plans worked out at San Francisco, certain Allied business firms, together with their friends in the State Department, the Army, and the British Foreign Office, are going to maneuver behind the scenes to strengthen Germany once again as a bulwark against Russia. This largely lies at the root of the ticklish Polish question. Russia wants a Poland which will cooperate with her and be a buffer against another German invasion. Before Poland was invaded last time, It will be remembered that British business interests were quite willing, even apparently anxious, to have the Sudetenland taken away from Czechoslovakia. Finally, it was American and British banks which poured money into Germany for years before the war, and then maneuvered to have reparations and war debts canceled in order to protect their own loans.